This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Remember back when everybody was really angry about the financial crisis, raising a collective fist at Congress and regulators and demanding reform? How could that kind of reform not happen, right? Yeah, that was a long, long time ago. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. And by the new Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at hbr.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us on this Monday. It is the 26th day of April. It's been more than a year and a half since the U.S. stock market and economy went into a tailspin, and there's been a lot of talk of reform to go along with recriminations. Today, the Senate is expected to vote on whether a major overhaul of the financial regulatory system will go forward. And as they search for some sliver of bipartisan agreement, a divisive new issue has come to the fore. It's all about grandfathering in the current contracts for the complex financial instruments known as derivatives. Should they be subject to any new rules? Marketplace's John Dimsdale has more.
The reform bill requires derivative traders to set aside money as collateral to cover potential losses when their bets go bad. Current derivative holders want an amendment to exempt existing contracts from those collateral requirements. Brookings fellow Douglas Elliott says exemptions are a bad idea because even existing contracts carry substantial risks.
If we increase the requirements, as this bill would do, even if the party on the other side can't fulfill their obligations, at least some of that loss will be taken care of by the collateral.
But requiring derivative holders to set aside billions of dollars would hurt the economy, says Ryan McKee at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Any new requirements would be a significant drain on the working capital that they would otherwise be using to create jobs, to grow their businesses, to invest in research and development.
Despite some powerful lobbying, including from Berkshire Hathaway CEO Warren Buffett, the bill heading to the Senate floor would not exempt derivative holders from extra collateral requirements. Christopher Whalen at Institutional Risk Analytics says derivative traders have been able to place bets without backing them up for too long.
And it's especially obnoxious to see Warren Buffett leading this effort. He's the man who told us that these derivatives were weapons of mass destruction.
Berkshire Hathaway owns more than $60 billion in derivatives contracts. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Hertz is maneuvering to drive a hard bargain. The world's biggest rental car company historically focused its attention on the higher-paying business traveler. But now it's aiming to grab a bigger share of the vacation rental market. It's buying the Dollar Thrifty Automotive Group for $1.2 billion. As Marketplace's Bob Moon reports, consumers will still have plenty of rental car brands to choose from, but just a few major corporations will hold the keys.
In case you hadn't noticed, the rental car business has been consolidating for years. Avis and Budget are operated by one company, and not too long ago, Enterprise bought National and Alamo. Now, Hertz is snapping up two more of the bigger names, Dollar and Thrifty. Neil Abrams is a rental car industry consultant.
This is the last piece of the puzzle, the mosaic, that will become the U.S. rental industry. You'll have three corporations running the eight major brands.
So why maintain all those brands? It turns out a rental car company isn't that much different than, say, a cereal company.
Kellogg's owns a lot of cereal brands. They offer different values, different experiences to different customers, and it's no different than the rental industry.
Not everyone, for example, needs the speed or convenience the Hertz Number One Club offers, but Dave Kilduff, who follows the industry for Carlson Wagenlied Travel, says Hertz still wants to compete in the less demanding leisure market.
You know, Hertz has to gear up for that businessman that comes in on Monday and Tuesday, and they put a lot of structure, and you have to have a lot of people and planning for that. You know, you're not going to get that with Dollar Thrifty. So it's a different level of service. It's still a good service.
And it's still going to be cheaper to appeal to leisure travelers. Analysts say that market remains competitive, and if anything, combining the back office expenses might actually help Hertz hold the line on prices. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
A dead author is making a big splash in the publishing industry. William Styron wrote towering works of literature, Sophie's Choice among them. Styron died 4 years ago. His work is about to be published as electronic books, but the author's longtime publisher will not be collecting the profits. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
Random House has published William Styron's books for decades, but the rights to those same books in digital form went to a new company called Open Road. Peter Hildick Smith is president of Codex Group, which does market analysis for book publishers. He says the move is bad for Random House since ebooks are expected to fuel growth in the industry.
Not being able to hold on to the ebook rights for a major author like that becomes problematic because if that's where the growth is coming from, you sort of get disenfranchised from that whole distribution channel.
But Random House isn't throwing in the towel. Spokesman Stuart Applebaum says the Styron case is unique. As a general policy, he says,
our publishing agreements grant us the right to publish our authors' works in all text-based versions of the work, including electronic publication formats.
Popular older books are important for publishers like Random House. They bring in revenue without requiring a big marketing budget. At the same time, Applebaum says authors will sell more books, digital or otherwise, by sticking with a giant like Random House.
We have the resources and capital to maximize their sales.
Styron's family will get a bigger share of revenue from digital books sold on Open Road, about twice what Random House paid. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, stocks edged lower despite strong results from a major equipment manufacturer. We'll have details when we do the numbers. The government's $8,000 first-time homebuyer tax credit expires on Friday. If you haven't entered into a contract to buy a house by then, you are not getting anything back from Uncle Sam. But you very well may get something back from one of the nation's biggest real estate companies. Coldwell Banker says it will make the credit an option for sellers participating in its buyer bonus sales event. Homebuyers would have until July 31st to take advantage of the offer. For some insight, we turn to Leonard Zampano. He teaches finance at the University of Alabama. Good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
You know, before we get to what Coldwell Banker is doing, let's take a bit of a broader picture of the housing market. Did the homebuyer tax credit actually make people buy homes?
It has. The National Association of Realtors does an annual home buying and selling survey, and their numbers indicate that the tax credit was responsible for approximately 800,000 home sales. To put this in perspective, it includes the original $7,500 refundable tax credit, the $8,000 first-time home buyer credit, and the extended credit that allows for credit for existing home sales.
Well, 800,000 people sounds like a lot.
It is a lot in absolute numbers, but during that same time period, there were 5 million homes sold. That's about 16%, which is not insignificant. Of all the reasons for purchasing a home, The tax credit was singled out by 16% of those homebuyers.
800,000 people saying that the credit factored in. The fact that it is now ending would presumably prompt a little bit of panic on the part of the realtors then.
One would expect that the availability of the credit and having a limited life expectancy ending in the end of the month put people that might have been sitting on the fence over the fence. So I think there'll probably be a decline in future home sales in the next couple of months, assuming nothing else changes like employment and mortgage rates.
Right.
I think part of the most recent push were from home buyers who were watching interest rates beginning to rise.
Well, certainly for Coldwell Banker, this is quite the unique marketing technique. Hey, you know, if Uncle Sam isn't going to help you out, we will.
Yeah. That's exactly right. But how profound is that going to be and what kind of incentive does it create? It's difficult to forecast because it may, in fact, cause other real estate companies to do basically the same thing.
Right. That just means we're back in 2004, 2005, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There is evidence that the market is beginning to firm up. The most recent numbers I've seen for part of 2009 show that those states that suffered the worst in 2007, like California, are coming back. Buyers are being induced back into the market, and that's happening also in cities like Miami, which had a glut of condominiums just 2 years ago. With employment beginning to stabilize, you know, the prospects for housing market recovery are there. You're not going to see the kind of appreciation we saw between 2000 and 2005, but I don't want to ever see that again because that was simply unsustainable, and everybody knew it.
Leonard Zampano is a professor of finance with an emphasis on real estate at the University of Alabama. Thanks so much for chatting with us today.
My pleasure.
Last year, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that corporations and unions are people, too. And as such, they are allowed to spend unlimited amounts of money to bankroll political campaign ads. But this week, legislation is expected to be introduced in Congress that would require CEOs to put a name and a face to any ads pushing one or the other candidate. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more from Washington.
The new campaign finance legislation would require CEO cameo appearances. It includes a provision known as Stand By Your Ad. CEOs would have to show their faces at the end of a political ad, saying their company paid for it. Joseph Priester teaches marketing at the University of Southern California. He doesn't think the CEO's disclosures would go over too well with consumers, especially now.
Now there's this tension between Wall Street versus Main Street and sort of my money versus these corporations' monies. People are going to be particularly sensitive to the perception that Wall Street is sort of influencing their local politics or their national politics.
That's the whole point of the legislation. Public shaming might deter corporate funding for ads. Democrat Chris Van Hollen of Maryland is co-sponsor in the House. There will be a similar bill in the Senate. Van Hollen says his bill would make CEOs think twice before getting behind a campaign ad.
CEOs are going to have to make these choices about whether or not they want to take their shareholder dollars and spend them to try and influence these campaigns when the voters are going to know who's funding them.
Of course, corporations could still funnel money to third parties like trade associations and have them pay for the ads. They've been doing a lot of that lately. The Chamber of Commerce, financed by corporate donations, spent $1 million on ads for Massachusetts Republican Scott Brown. He eventually won the special election for Ted Kennedy's Senate seat.
The Washington politicians continue to fail us. Scott Brown believes in fiscal responsibility.
Under Van Hollen's bill, the CEO of the Chamber of Commerce would have to appear at the end of ads like this. That would be followed by a list of the ad's top five funders. The chamber would have to list the rest of the donors on the web. Van Hollen says that would prevent corporations from hiding behind third parties. But Trevor Potter isn't so sure. He's a former chairman of the Federal Election Commission who now heads the Campaign Legal Center.
If you are one of 100 donors to the Chamber of Commerce, which is going to run ads, and the limit of the disclosure is you're on a list of donors. Is that going to worry corporations? Is that going to prevent them from doing it? I don't know. I doubt it.
But Potter says the top donors, who would be listed in the commercials, might shy away. And Van Hollen's bill does a couple more things. Companies that got federal money or government contracts wouldn't be able to buy campaign commercials. And firms that have more than 20% foreign ownership wouldn't be able to spend on campaign ads either. The constitutionality of those parts of the bill might be challenged. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up, Wall Street looks back.
I remember my clients who had been there for 10 years carrying their boxes out the door. And to me, that was a defining experience.
But first, let's do the numbers. The markets closed mixed as worries over financial regulations offset another day of strong earnings reports. The Dow picked up a fraction of a percent, less than a point, to finish at 11,205. The Nasdaq lost 7 points, almost 0.3%, to close at 2522. And the S&P slid 5 points, 0.4%, to wrap up at 1,212. Bank stocks took a beating. Shares of Goldman Sachs dropped more than 3%. JPMorgan Chase shed more than 2%. And now for the good news, the maker of earth movers, Caterpillar, bulldozed up more than 4% on good quarterly profits of its own. Shares of Hertz sped 14% higher after saying it would buy Dollar Thrifty. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.81%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. President Obama starts a two-day tour of Iowa, Missouri, and Illinois. He'll meet with locals to discuss the economy and hear about the challenges they face. In New York, the Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index, and the Federal Reserve meets for one of its 8 regularly scheduled meetings of the year on interest rates and the economy. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. Today and tomorrow, President Barack Obama is hosting an unlikely gathering of delegates from Muslim nations. The event is being called an Entrepreneurship Summit, a follow-up to his speech last June in Cairo, where he called for more democracy in the region and better relations with the U.S. It's billed as a grassroots affair, real entrepreneurs from both sides trading ideas and business cards. Our entrepreneurship reporter, Mitchell Hartman, joins us with the details. Hi, Mitchell.
Hi, Tess.
So, an entrepreneurship summit for Muslim-majority nations. This is what the White House is calling it. What is actually going on here?
Well, on a first pass, it looks pretty impressive. There are 50 countries represented, 250 or so entrepreneurs and funders. It's everyone from microlenders like Mohammed Yunus of Grameen Bank to the biggest private equity firm in the Middle East. There's also a lot of U.S. Firepower on the podium. Not only the president speaking today, but Yahoo co-founder Jerry Yang, and tomorrow Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. There'll also be announcements about U.S. support for trade and education, as well as science and technology assistance.
So it sounds like we might call this the new entrepreneurial diplomacy, but the question, of course, is it going to work?
Well, you know, it's not religion. It's not politics. We know how well we've done talking about those things. Mm-hmm. This is a little more under the radar. On the other hand, it's not a completely foreign language either. As one Indian American entrepreneur I know put it, the old word for entrepreneur is trader. Arabs and Muslims, he says, have been doing this for 1,000 years or more. So this certainly does appeal to cultural roots. Still, you know, everything is political with U.S.-Muslim relations, and there's plenty of skepticism. Indian journalist Aziz Hanifa asked the question in an administration press conference on the web just before the summit.
How would you sort of rebut the contention that this is sort of a huge propaganda exercise by giving all of them a free trip and then hopefully getting them to go back and not be anti-American?
You know, he says go back and not be any American, like it's a bad thing. The administration does want them to do that. But they do say, you know, it's not a junket with a bunch of finance ministry officials. It's grassroots entrepreneurs from all over the Muslim world. They'll go home with connections, with some assistance, and with a big moral thumbs up from the U.S.
But what kind of challenges might they be going home with as well?
Well, lack of funding and technology to start with, for sure. But, you know, it's not a monolith. You have Indonesia and India, where entrepreneurship is very vibrant. You have places like Egypt and Syria with state-controlled economies and plenty of corruption. One real concern across the region is women. They're key to businesses getting off the ground and pulling communities out of poverty. But in some parts of the Muslim world, they're not free to work or get an education. I asked Rabia Jalani about this. She's at the summit. She's 28. She's from Pakistan, and she runs a small firm in the D.C. area that helps immigrant businesses.
As a woman from Pakistan, what I saw was a lot of males were generally inclined towards being entrepreneurs, whereas females wouldn't really consider entrepreneurship as a choice, and there wasn't that much support.
And that's a point that Secretary of State Clinton's sure to stress in her speech and a meeting afterward with women entrepreneurs.
All right. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman joining us to talk about the president's entrepreneurship summit in Washington today. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Tess.
As we've already mentioned, the stock market did a whole lot of nothing today. The major index has moved just a fraction of a percent. And yet, the Dow Industrials are now within striking distance of a psychologically important threshold. They're about to hit the number at which they stood before Lehman Brothers collapsed. In other words, the Dow is about to erase all losses from the financial crisis. So, what better opportunity to ask what, if anything, has changed on Wall Street since then? Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson went looking for some answers.
I moved from Marketplace's Washington Bureau to the New York Bureau exactly a week before Lehman Brothers crumbled. I was getting used to a new city and a new beat, and on my first morning on the job, Monday, September 8, 2008, I took a trip to the New York Stock Exchange. Ted Weisberg was my guide. He's been a trader for decades and runs a brokerage called Seaport Securities.
We were kind of looking at financial history before our very eyes.
That's because September 8th was the day Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were seized by the federal government, the opening salvo in the crisis we all remember so well. But Ted Weisberg says, in hindsight, it was just another bad day in his 50-year career.
It looked like the end of the world financially in the early 70s, 73, 74, and I've seen it a couple of times since, 87. The reasons are always different, but the emotions of the moment are always the same. And if you're in this business long enough, this business rewards you for these experiences, and you learn from these experiences.
And he says Wall Street has learned. So does Ray Shirazi. He's a securities and derivatives specialist at the law firm Cadwallader, Wickersham & Taft. His office on the 33rd floor of the World Financial Center overlooks the site of another disaster, the 9/11 attacks. But he's got memories from the financial crisis that will never leave him.
During the collapse of one of my clients, I remember my clients who had been there for 10 years carrying their boxes out the door. And to me, that was a defining experience.
Because he says it showed him how fragile the U.S. economy is and how much care is needed to maintain it. It showed him the real-life effects of all the decisions being made in the towers of Lower Manhattan.
The world has become much more careful in the post-Lehman world. People are very, very much concerned about the safety and security of their assets.
He says even before any meaningful regulation is passed, the market is adjusting to a new landscape. Mortgage-backed investments and those complex collateralized debt obligations are out. Shirazi says these days, most investors are looking for the same thing.
Simple, cash market transactions that are very, very transparent. I think that there's an appetite for that.
I wanted to check in with one more person I met in my early New York days, Christopher Maraldi, a 20-year Wall Street employee laid off in the early days of the Great Recession. We met up in Central Park. He tells me he's still in touch with people on Wall Street, and he doesn't think anything has changed.
They're out to make money. That's what motivates them. That's what excites them. You know, if the music is still playing, they're going to dance. And, you know, it's only when the market stops and there's no buyer for that security will they stop selling it. But if they can sell it, they will market it.
Maraldi says new regulation is the only way to change things on Wall Street. And he says his former colleague should take it from him. Change isn't such a bad thing.
I think no one likes to see their salaries go down or that their job change. But it's not the end of the world, you know, when you have to adjust your lifestyle. I mean, there's so many things that are still great in your life, so.
As I leave Maraldi in Central Park, he heads off with a smile. After months of unemployment, he's starting a new job, managing a group of employees for the Census Bureau. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Californians will vote on an historic ballot proposition this year, one that would legalize possession of marijuana. Meanwhile, the state is still grappling with its current law, which allows marijuana use for medical purposes. The latest battle lines are being drawn in the town of Norco, California. That's Norco, by the way, not Narco. Two members of a medical marijuana collective were cited for operating a rolling dispensary, selling pot out of a motorhome. The couple says they will fight the citation in court. The Marketplace players know a few people who hope they win.
La, 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 la.
Hey, dude. You're the dudes who sell weed, right?
We're a roving medical cannabis dispensary.
Right on. You cool if I park my truck over here beside you?
Are you a patient?
No, I sell tacos. I'll just pull it over here. All right.
You understand we cater to sick people, right?
Yeah, sick with the munchies.
Hey, you're the weed truck.
Medical cannabis.
Cool, we're the peanut butter pizza truck.
All right, how long have you guys been around?
Since we heard about the weed truck. We'll park over there.
Hey, you got room for a Jolly Rancher and an eye drops truck?
No, we do not.
Sure, dude, over here, I'll guide you in.
Howdy.
What are you selling?
I'm Woody Harrelson.
We're rich!
Rico Galliano wrote that piece with help from Jason Berlin.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. By the New Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at hbr.org. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, the CEO of Goldman Sachs will come out swinging when he testifies before a Senate hearing tomorrow. In written remarks already delivered to Capitol Hill, Lloyd Blankfein denies recent charges by the Securities and Exchange Commission that the firm defrauded its clients. Goldman has been under fire for allegedly selling investments that were designed by a hedge fund manager who then bet against those very investments. Blankfein also says that contrary to recently released corporate emails, the firm lost more than $1 billion in the housing bust. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose almost 1 point, a fraction of a percent. The Nasdaq dropped 7 points, a third of a percent. And the S&P 500 lost 5 points, 0.4%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, Shrinking Neighborhoods in Detroit.
It's just like the old reservations. You tell the Native Americans we're going to give you land somewhere else, and you move them somewhere else, and then there's no clear understanding as to what's going to happen.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.